Oh, Mr. Benny.
Huh? Huh? Who are you? What are you doing in my bedroom?
We just came out of your radio. We're the quartet called the Sportsmen.
Say, you fellas are wonderful. See, I wish you were my quartet.
We are.
You mean you're the same fellas who do my commercials? Say, you are the guys. Well, let me ask you something. Why don't you sing for me like you did on that program I just heard?
Because you antagonize us.
I do not.
You do too.
Now, wait a minute. Wait a minute, you fellas. This is some trick. You're not the same guys who do my commercials.
Oh, we're not, eh?
L-S-L-S-M-F-T, la 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 la. L-S-L-S-M-F-T, la 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 la. Stop it! Stop it! You guys think you're so smart. Well, this is the last time I'm going to have trouble with you.
Put down that gun.
It's too late now. Take that. Gee, tenors are hard to kill. Well, I guess that'll hold you for a while. Now, come on, you guys. Come on, get out of here. Get out of... Wait a minute. They're dead. I killed them. But I didn't mean to.
Order in the court. Order in the court.
In the court? What am I doing here?
The next trial will be the case of Jack Benny versus the people of Anaheim, Azusa, and my darling Clementine.
Wait a minute. What am I charged with?
You are charged with killing your quartet.
That's a crime?
Yes. And not only murder, but the court attendant will read the following charges.
On the night of September 30th, Jack Benny, willfully and with malice aforethought, did... You'll be sorry.
I did all that?
Yes, and anything you say will be used against you.
But look...
You better let your lawyer do all your talking.
But I haven't got a lawyer. This is a fine how do you do.
How do you do?
You, Dennis. Dennis, you're my lawyer?
Silly boy.
Dennis, you... My lawyer.
Certainly. Don't you remember you hired me for $35 a week?
But, kid, I only hired you to sing on my radio program.
Yes, but in the fine print of my contract, it says that I have to be your lawyer when I'm not mowing your lawn.
Oh, yes. Yes, I remember I hired you because you weighed 140 pounds stripped.
Everyone rise. Here comes His Honor, the judge.
What is this? I don't need any trial. When the judge hears my story, he'll know that I'm innocent. He has such a kind, intelligent face. Oh, Judge?
Yes.
Oh. Are you the judge?
Yes. And let's get on with the execution.
You mean trial.
I know how it's going to end.
Judge, you mean I'm going to be Dennis? Dennis, you're my lawyer. Say something.
To each his own. What? It's either that or plead guilty.
Gee, I'm glad you thought of that.
Hiya, Jackson.
Phil, what are you doing here?
I'm the district attorney, and I ain't going to rest until you're executed.
Hey, you're the district attorney. You've got two shows now. Who appointed you district attorney?
Petrello.
Oh, but Phil. Phil, you're not a lawyer. You're a musician. I know you're a musician.
Oh, trying to plead insanity, huh?
But I'm not. I'm not trying to plead insanity.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt this trial to bring you a spot announcement. Thank you, Fido.
Fido? What happened to Spot? Oh, well. He was probably just a summer replacement. Anyway, I know I'll get out of this mess. I know I will.
Sure you will, Jack. Don't worry.
Don, where'd you come from?
Eastern Columbia, Broadway at night.
What?
I'm the big Cluck.
That's Clark.
And now the prosecution calls its surprise witness, Miss Mary Livingston.
Fellas, make room. Hello, Filzy. Hiya, Judge.
Miss Livingston, please take your usual seat.
No, Judge, I might spoil the crease in your pants. I better sit in the witness chair.
Gee, and they're nylons, too. And look at those fog lights on her knees. With dimples on them.
Miss Livingston, before you're allowed to testify, the bailiff will swear you in. Go ahead, Bay.
Miss Livingston, do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, with pickle in the middle and the mustard on top?
No, with the mustard in the middle and the bananas in the refrigerator.
Gee, is that the way they swear in witnesses today?
Now, Miss Livingston, as the prosecuting attorney, I want to ask you, have you ever been out on a date with the defendant, Jack Benny?
Yes, several times.
Did Mr. Benny ever attempt to kiss you?
Sure. Mr. Benny is a caveman type of lover.
Caveman type of lover?
Yes, one kiss and he caves in.
I do not.
Now, Miss Livingston, concerning the alleged murder of this quartet,
objection
do you...
Objection overruled.
But nobody objected.
I know, and it was getting awfully dull.
Dennis, the judge is against me. I'm afraid. I'm afraid, I tell you.
Order in the court. The 497th day of the trial of Jack Benny is on.
Gee, I'm so tired.
Now, miss, you're a brand new witness. Please tell us all about yourself.
I am a telephone operator. My name is Gertrude Gearshift. I work at NBC. Wednesday is my night off, if you know what I mean.
Now, when you work at NBC, you hear all the telephone conversations that come through, don't you?
No, there are other switchboards. I'm on the first, Mabel's on the second, and Greenberg's on third.
Greenberg? How did he get in here?
Now, Miss Gearshift, you asked to be brought here as a witness. Tell the court in your own words exactly what you said to me in my office this afternoon.
I said, stop, you're smearing my lipstick.
No.
I said that too, but you wouldn't listen.
Dennis, I don't like the way the trial is going. I tell you, I'm worried.
Now, Mr. Benny, will you please take the stand?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Benny, what is your occupation?
I am the fiddler. I play by night. I influence.
Order in the court. The jury will now give their verdict.
So fast?
Foreman, have you reached a verdict? Good. What is your decision?
We find the defendant, Jack Benny, guilty of... Guilty of...
Guilty of what?
The whole thing.
But this is ridiculous. I'm innocent, I tell you. I never was responsible for anyone's death in my entire life.
What about the gas man?
Rochester, stand aside. Your Honor, please listen to me. Your Honor, I admit that I killed my quartet. But it was justifiable homicide. They were making me a nervous wreck. They were
They were driving me crazy. I was paying them $500 a week. They never sang good for me. They always sang beautifully on other programs. So pretty with such beautiful harmony. I remember because I heard them the night I killed them. I was lying in bed and I turned on my radio. Well, what do you know? I forgot to turn off the radio.
We were lied to for years, but now we know that fluoride is industrial waste and also used as poison for rodents. We know this, and there's still fluoride in toothpastes and in your tap water. And what about the other pollutants? You need serious protection. Bottled water? You don't know what you're getting. Don't let that picture of pristine-looking natural springs on the label fool you. Industry's carelessness in disposing of waste has made spring water safety questionable. That's why Daniel Chapter 1 developed the WaterClean Fluoride Reduction System, a revolutionary one-of-a-kind water filter. It filters up to 96% of fluoride, as well as bacteria, viruses, heavy metals, and many toxic chemicals. The WaterClean FRS design comes from the help of scientists at NASA. Yeah, the same guys that actually understand rocket science. This phenomenal filter cannot be found anywhere but at Daniel Chapter 1. Call 800-504-5511. Toll free, 800-504-5511. Make your water clean with WaterClean FRS.
Gee, that was one of the silliest dreams I ever had. Oh, well, I'll get back to sleep again.
It was passed into law. The truth of the matter is Obamacare was actually two parts. The second part was the health care bill passed into law in March of 2010. But the first part was hidden in the stimulus bill.
Any limit or measure, the father loves his son. And he has given him authority over everything. All who believe in God's Son will have eternal life. Those who do not obey the Son will never experience eternal life, but the wrath, the anger of God will remain on them.
So, what does it mean for the Messiah to have authority over everything?
What does the word authority mean to you, Andrew?
Well, I know about authority figures. That's anyone who's in charge of something or other people.
Well, you already have a pretty good idea about what it means for the Messiah to have authority over everything. It means, really, that Messiah is in charge of the whole universe, just like God.
So the Messiah is just like God and can do whatever he wants, right?
Yes, but not as you would think. Whatever God or his Messiah does is not the same as people doing whatever they want. God is good, so that whatever he wants is good. John the Baptist was talking in particular about the authority of Jesus Christ in eternal life. This means that Jesus has the authority to give eternal life to those who believe in him and accept his authority. John was saying that Jesus' power was a real power to give eternal life. We accept this by faith. We do not understand, but we believe that Jesus is telling us the truth. We trust him for everything, what we understand and what we do not understand.
John the Baptist continued preaching without fear of the consequences. Again and again, John preached against sinful living. John did not even fear Herod, the governor of the region. Herod had married Herodias, the wife of his brother Philip. John said that it was unlawful for Herod to take Herodias as his wife. This was simply adultery.
When Herod learned about this, both he and his wife became furious with John. Herodias insisted that John be punished for his actions, but Herod was no fool. Herod was cautious in his action. He knew that the people regarded John as a prophet. Herod really wanted to have John killed. But for the moment, he sent soldiers to find John and arrest him.
The soldiers found John near the Jordan River. John was arrested. John's disciples were very upset, but there was nothing they could do. The soldiers did not mistreat John, not knowing how the crowd might react. They surrounded John and led him away. Some of the crowd followed a group of soldiers as they proceeded to the prison at Macherius, a few miles east of the Dead Sea.
We now come to the part of the story where Jesus begins his public ministry in the region of Galilee. Not long after Jesus returned from his experience in the wilderness, there was a wedding in Cana. Jesus walked from the wilderness to Cana. Mary, Jesus' mother, went to the wedding with Jesus and his disciples.
Wedding celebrations in those days were very long. Sometimes the celebration lasted for several days. During the wedding feast, Mary told Jesus the host had used the last of the wine that had been provided. Mary was concerned that the bridegroom would be humiliated in front of all the friends and neighbors. She spoke to Jesus.
Jesus, Jesus, my son, the family has used the last of the wine. There's no more wine for the guests.
Why are you telling me about the wine? This is not the time and place for me to be concerned with such things.
Mary looked at Jesus. Then she turned and spoke to one of the servants.
Do whatever he tells you.
There were 6 stone pots close by. Jesus told the servants to fill the water pots with water. The servants took the water pots to the well, filled them to the top, brought them to Jesus. Jesus told one of the servants to draw some water from the water pot and take it to the host. The host took the cup from the servant. He was surprised, and he called to the bridegroom. At most weddings, the best wines are served first. But the bridegroom had saved the finest wine for the end of the celebration. The servants were amazed and were whispering to each other. They were certain that they had filled the water pots with water, and now the water pots were filled with excellent wine.
Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro Libertate Radio, a full-throttle, no-holds-barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gray.
Greetings, fellow freedom zealots, kindred refractories, irreconcilables, and other worthy extremists. This is Pro Libertate Radio, and I'm your host, William Grigg. It's an honor and a privilege to be with you this afternoon on this inaugural edition of Pro Libertate Radio. If you're interested in joining the discussion, and by all means, please do, we have a toll-free number, 1-866-986-6397. That's 1-866-986-NEWS. 1-866-986-6397. Once again, my name is William Grigg. I am a blogger. I'm part of that disreputable herd in the blogosphere who pollute the internet with radical opinions about liberty. I'm also, as production said, an investigative reporter, a published author. I've published 5 books. I've done something on the order of a dozen video documentaries. I've got a 6th and a 7th book gestating right now, and also for the last 3 years, as previously mentioned, have published the Pro Libertate blog. If you're interested in checking out what I have to say online, go to freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Once again, these are condensed words. These are compound words. freedominourtime.blogspot.com, or go to willgrigg.com. Look at the left links. Right at the top of that page of hyperlinks, you have a link to Pro Libertate. I publish between 3 and 5 essays a week, usually about 1,200 words to 2,000 words in length. This is not your typical blog. I'm not writing a 3-dot column a la Larry King. These are not mere random stream of consciousness, free association observations about the passing scene. These are essays between 1,200 to 2,000 words, usually having something to do with the manifold ways that the government ruling us is making life miserable for honest, productive people. Now, I used some terms at the beginning of the program this evening. I think it's a good idea to define our terms. I mentioned freedom zealots. A freedom zealot is an individual who is obsessed with protecting life, liberty, and property. I've called myself a freedom zealot for about a decade now. As a matter of fact, when I was involved in an online chat room devoted to mixed martial arts, there was a roll call once when somebody who was looking with disparagement upon the views of us who were obsessed with individual liberty said, "Who are the freedom zealots on this list?" And I was the first one in the pool. So I'm the original freedom zealot, if you will. But I know that there are millions of us out there, somebody who's obsessed with life, liberty, and property, the protection of the same. Refractory. Now, that's not a term you hear a lot in contemporary conversation. That's a term of abuse, actually, that was thrown in the face of the people back in France in the late 18th century who wanted to protect their life, liberty, and property from the onslaught of the French Revolution, the Jacobinical Revolution that was sort of the prototype for the communist revolutions, and for that matter, the fascist revolutions of the 20th century. Refractories are people who are just not with the program. And there were people who did not quit in spite of the fact that the odds were very long in opposition to them. There was a whole group of people in a region of the France called the Vendée, as a matter of fact, who ended up coming under siege by the revolutionary government. About 750,000 of them were killed. The Vendéans were probably the best example of refractories. A refractory is simply somebody who's stubborn, someone who's too stubborn to quit, no matter how powerful the enemy appears to be or how hopeless his cause seems to be. So I think there's something admirable in that type of stubbornness. And irreconcilable is anybody who is committed to preserving his independence, whether you're talking about individual autonomy, first and most importantly, or national independence in the service of protecting individual rights. I see nothing at all desirable about maintaining our national independence if we become a dictatorship in one country or a police state within secure borders, that is. I don't think there's anything desirable about that. It all starts with individual liberty because I believe that we were created, there's an important axiom in my thinking, we were created to be free and independent. Now, I've got to give you a full disclosure statement here of my prejudices. Like everybody else in the world, I'm governed by certain axioms, certain prejudices, certain assumptions, and I want to share a few of them with you and see if you share some of them with me. The first of which is that freedom is the highest political good. There are goods in the eternities, perhaps, that are more important than freedom, but in terms of politics, the management of human affairs, freedom is the highest good, highest political good. The existence of government, in my opinion, is acceptable only to the extent that it protects individual life, liberty, and property. That's the only excuse for having a government to begin with. The U.S. Constitution is an admirable, laudable document. It's a wonderful political artifact. I think that it bespeaks a certain genius on the part of the men who wrote it. Bear in mind that these are men who are writing a law to govern themselves and limit what they could do with power. That's really quite an anomaly in human history. And I think that the Constitution is, to paraphrase Blackstone, the most wonderful political document ever struck off by the mind and genius of man. That having been said, I do think that there are some flaws in the document, in the sense that it's worthy of defense as a minimum standard where limitation of government power is concerned. I think that any conversation about government begins with the Constitution. And that where we're going to be moving in some direction away from the Constitution, it would be towards greater impediments on government power. For instance, I'm not crazy about eminent domain. I think that eminent domain is the mother of many evils. I'm not crazy about the fact that Congress has the power to suspend habeas corpus. I don't think that habeas corpus should be suspended at any time by any agency of government. It's a couple of examples of some of the things I would change if I were to change the Constitution, and they all move in the direction of greater enhancement of the protection of individual liberty and greater imposition on the powers of government, limitations thereon. All governments, the one ruling us very much included, in my opinion, are criminal syndicates seeking a monopoly on violence in the service of corrupt ambition and material greed. Go back and read St. Augustine's work, The City of God, Book 4, Chapter 4, Justice Being Taken Away, What Are Kingdoms But Vast Robberies. It's in that same section of City of God that you'll find the parable of the emperor and the pirate. We all know the story by now, at least I would hope we know the story about how the emperor of Rome was vexed by a pirate, and he had the pirate brought before him. And the pirate said to the emperor, "Get over yourself, we're in the same racket. But because you pillage the world with an army, you're called an emperor. Because I do it with a handful of small ships rather than your vast navy, I'm called a pirate. We're basically in the same line of work." That's the nature and disposition of every government that we're going to run into. Our own government, of course, and I use that term advisedly, our government, the government ruling us is a better way of stating it, very much included in that list. Now, my opinion with respect to authority is interesting and bound to be a subject of some controversy. My opinion is that the only natural and defensible form of innate authority is to be found in the family. It's parental authority, because it's obvious that a parent and a child are not co-equals. All other authority, in my opinion, is a function of contract, commerce, or covenant. There are certain types of covenantal authority if you're talking about religious associations. I believe that marriage, for instance, is a covenantal association rather than a state-managed contract, or at least should be such. I don't believe that the government should be in the business of issuing a license to do something which the state didn't create in the first place, namely, this instance, we're talking about marriage. That's just a good example of what I'm talking about. So I believe that all authority begins with parental authority, and then after that, you've got to be talking about matters of contract. That being said, I don't believe in what is called the social contract. I don't believe that you have a situation where people can bind future generations to a particular form of government in perpetuity. That's a very obnoxious theory that I think really started with Rousseau, who was the intellectual architect of the French Revolution, and we talked about that just a little bit ago. The French Revolution being really the grand progenitor of every project in totalitarianism that has vexed humanity since the 18th century. We have a call already. James from Michigan is on the line. James, are you there?
I'm here. Hello.
How are you doing today?
Good. I'm just wanted to give a big hearty hello from Upper Michigan. It's about 45 degrees and raining.
Really?
And hammer handles, but we're glad to get some rain.
Sure.
Wanted to call and say hello and tell you nice to hear your voice, and I enjoy reading your blog. I've learned a lot of good information off your writing.
Well, I really, really appreciate that, and it's interesting to hear from somebody in Michigan. My family and I lived in Wisconsin until 2005, and I was reading that in Green Bay, I think it was yesterday, they set an all-time record for cold weather, cold temperature this time of year.
Yeah, it's been really cold the whole all spring, basically.
Whole Midwest.
Yeah, so
yeah, I don't really miss that.
No, but it's supposed to warm up next week, so that'd be great.
Oh, that's good. I mean, there are many wonderful and charming things about that part of the country, but the weather is not on that list as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
I was just in the weight room about an hour and a half ago, and I was talking with somebody about my experiences in Wisconsin. I lived there for about a dozen years. I moved there in 1993 and said, "What am I doing here? I don't really like football. I can't eat cheese. I don't drink beer. What am I doing in Wisconsin?"
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't all beer, football, and cheese. I mean, there were a lot of other worthy things going on in Wisconsin and of course, in Michigan as well. James, thanks so much for calling.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye. God bless. It's great to hear from you. Once again, 866-986-6397. If you want to call in and take part in the discussion today, please do. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio. I'll be with you on the other side of this commercial break.
To our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
Some of you might have seen this already. July 27th through July 31st, we're going to have a National Level Exercise 2009 brought to us by our good friends at FEMA. It is designated as a Tier 1 National Level Exercise. Tier 1 exercises, formerly known as the Top Officials Exercise Series, or Top Off, that's an expression some of you might have heard before, are conducted annually in accordance with the National Exercise Program, NEP, which serves as the nation's overarching exercise program for planning, organizing, conducting, and evaluating national-level exercises. Boy, there's a lot of boilerplate in this. The NEP was established to provide the U.S. government at all levels exercise opportunities to prepare for catastrophic crises ranging from terrorism to national disasters. NLE, National Level Exercise 09, is a White House-directed, congressionally mandated exercise that includes the participation of all appropriate federal department and agency senior officials, their deputy staff, and key operational elements. Now, this is where it gets interesting. In addition, broad regional participation of state, tribal, local, and private sector is anticipated. This year, the United States welcomes the participation of Australia, Canada, Mexico, and the United Kingdom in NLE 09. Now, last time I checked, Australia, Canada, Mexico, and the UK fit nowhere under the designation of state, tribal, local, and private sector. That's really quite interesting. Now, when you take a look at the involvement of Canada and Mexico, obviously there are certain things in that alignment that resonate with this demented plan for a North American Union patterned after a European Union. That's quite interesting. It's a program that is often discussed and often completely disavowed by people in positions of responsibility. But time and time and time again, we see this tripartite arrangement being mentioned with respect to economic policy and now emergency management and all kinds of other joint ventures where there's a commingling of sovereignty. Australia and the United Kingdom, of course, have nothing to do geographically with the United States. There's one ocean separating us from Australia, from the United Kingdom. Sometimes I find myself lamenting that there's only one ocean separating us from the UK. And there are several separating us from Australia, which is literally at antipodes from the United States. But there you go. FEMA collaborating with like-minded people on a national level exercise for crisis management next month. A couple of things I want to share with you this afternoon that I think are quite interesting. It's important to recognize that the two parties, so-called, in my opinion, are actually two wings of the same bird of prey. That's not my original expression. I believe it was the late Sam Francis who coined that expression, along with so many other worthy bon mots and mauve juice. But you've got to understand that the two parties, as they're presented to us, are part of the same political cartel. It's a little like going to certain shopping malls and urban developments of that sort, where you'll find restaurants that are all part of the same corporate structure, that all share in the profit structure of a given corporation, but they diversify in terms of what specifically they offer. You might have a seafood restaurant, an Italian restaurant, and a family restaurant of a more nondescript variety on the same corner. They're all owned by the same corporation, and you spend your money at one, you're really enriching the corporate base of all of them. The political parties act that way in a certain fashion. You have one that is tailored to people who style themselves progressives, and another that is tailored to people who style themselves as conservatives, but they're all playing the game between the 40-yard lines, if you will, to change the metaphor somewhat, politically speaking. And so you have very, very trivial cosmetic differences here. They pitch their wares in terms of what the polls say and the focus groups and the push polls determined would be a marketable way of appealing to a certain limited constituency. But they don't have any real material disagreements with respect to the Constitution or this bipartisan foreign policy that we hear about. And so when people talk about Barack Obama being a radical departure from George W. Bush, I find it difficult to credit that in anything other than the most superficial way, Mr. Obama is different from George W. Bush. Their personalities are quite different. Obama is a passably articulate man, at least when he has a teleprompter within his line of sight. He's somebody who has a certain appealing professorial mien about him. He has an admirable control of his temper, which is something I've struggled now for decades to achieve and have failed miserably, quite frankly. And in many ways, he's a lot more appealing personally than the choleric little spoiled child who is George W. Bush. But really, in terms of the policies, they're not that different. Mr. Obama picked up pretty much seamlessly from where George W. Bush left off in terms of the assault on the Constitution and on what remains of our economy and in propagating misery through an imperial foreign policy. And there are a couple of progressive columnists who've picked up on this theme that I want to share with you this afternoon. Some of you are familiar with Ted Rall, the cartoonist. He's also an opinion columnist, I believe, for I can't remember which of the syndicates he writes for, but the same syndicate that puts out his cartoons, puts out his columns. Matt Taibbi writes for Rolling Stone magazine. They're both people who consider themselves men of the left. The column that came out last week by Mr. Rawl is entitled, Mr. Obama, Resign Now. Now, that's really quite interesting because I was aware of the fact that there are people on the nominal right who want Barack Obama to resign. There are some who believe he should have been impeached. As a matter of fact, there was an impeach Obama movement that sprung up in November of last year. I believe that every president, by the way, should be impeached upon being inaugurated and be convicted upon his first offense against the Constitution, which would probably occur sometime after 12 noon on Inauguration Day. When they commit their first crime against decency or the rules that govern our government. But in any case, Mr. Rawl's column begins as follows. We expected broken promises, but the gap between the soaring expectations that accompanied Barack Obama's inauguration and his wretched performance is the broadest such chasm in recent historical memory. This guy makes Bill Clinton look like a paragon of integrity and follow-through. From health care to torture to the economy to war, Obama has reneged on pledges real and implied. So timid and so owned is he that he trembles for fear of offending, of all things, the government of Turkey. Obama has officially reneged on his campaign promise to acknowledge the Armenian genocide. When a president doesn't have the nads to annoy the Turks, why does he bother to show up for work in the morning? Obama is useless. Worse than that, he's dangerous, which is why, if he has any patriotism left, after the thousands of meetings he has sat through with corporate contributors, blood-sucking lobbyists, and corrupt politicians, he ought to step down now before he drags us any further into the abyss. And then Mr. Rawl goes on to talk about one particular betrayal that I find very outrageous as well, but entirely predictable if you know the dynamics of the two-party system, so-called. I refer here to Obama's plan for preventative detentions. If a cop or other government official thinks you might want to commit a crime someday, you could be held in prolonged detention. Reports in U.S. state-controlled media. Now, stop for a second. Reports in U.S. state-controlled media. When was the last time you heard a so-called respectable columnist admit that most of the media in this country is state-controlled? To continue, reports in U.S. state-controlled media imply that Obama's shocking new policy would only apply to Islamic terrorists or, in this case, wannabe Islamic terrorists, and also kind of sort of maybe thinking about terrorism dudes, as if that made it okay. In practice, Obama wants to let the government goons snatch you, me, and anyone else they deem annoying off the street. Preventive detention is the classic defining characteristic of a military dictatorship. Because dictatorial regimes rely on fear rather than consensus, their priority is self-preservation rather than improving their people's lives. They worry obsessively over the one thing they can't control, what Orwell called thought crime, contempt for rulers that might someday translate to direct action. It's amazing and incredible, concludes Mr. Rawl, that after 8 years of Bush's lawless behavior, to have to explain these things. For that reason alone, Obama should resign. Now, that's a pretty good place to start. Matt Taibbi enlarges upon basically the same questions and concepts in his piece that we'll review in just a few minutes after the next break. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio. Join you again after the break. 866-986-6397 if you want to call in. Hope to hear from you.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
Boy, that's a nice little blues groove, isn't it? It's appropriate. We're talking about some self-defined progressive columnists and commentators are singing the blues over Barack Obama's feckless continuation of the authoritarian policies of George W. Bush. This is Will Grigg once again, Pro Libertate Radio. If you want to take part in the conversation today, and please do, I'd love to hear from you. Our toll-free number is 1-866-986-6397. Again, that's 1-866-986-6397 or 1-866-986-NEWS. Oh, if you want to send me an email, I'll give my email out over the air. I really don't care. I want to hear from all and sundry. WN Grigg, that's WN as in Norman, as in psycho, wngrig@msn.com. wngrig@msn.com. My blog, Pro Libertate, is at freedominourtime.blogspot.com, or go to willgrig.com. Look at the right-hand side of the screen. There's a list of external links. Pro Libertate, the blog, is the very first one. We're talking about Matt Taibbi's piece on Barack Obama's embrace of the policy of preventative detention and the assault on habeas corpus. Look, habeas corpus is the defining due process guarantee. It's the defining civil liberty, if you will, the defining immunity against the abuse of individual rights by government, going back to Runnymede in 1215. What it means, habeas corpus, is that the government cannot simply lock you up indefinitely without creating a judicial means of establishing that you are legitimately accused of a definable crime. There's a very abrupt, very short time limit that the government has to lock you up in pretrial detention before you're brought before a judge and either formally charged with a crime or let go. Habeas corpus is the fundamental insulation, if you will, between the individual and arbitrary power of government. Well, since 2006 and the passage of the Military Commissions Act, we really don't have habeas corpus in this country. We're finding that more and more exceptions are being carved out of that defining civil liberty. And when you have a system of preventative detention that applies to anybody over whom the government claims jurisdiction, that's another important point. It doesn't matter the identity of a person or the nationality of the person. The Constitution applies everywhere the government presumes to exercise its authority. It limits what the government does. It doesn't define the rights of the individual. I certainly wish people would get that out of their minds. The idea that somehow we're extending rights to people by recognizing the limits on what government can do to people. See, they're two completely contrary points of view. Sean Hannity is one of the people who have promulgated the line that if we recognize the habeas corpus rights of people accused of the crime of terrorism, we're extending rights to people. Well, no, that's exactly the opposite. We're recognizing the limits on what government can do. And it doesn't really matter the identity or nationality of the person. What matters is what we permit government to do. And that which we license the government to do to one group of people applies to everybody. That's something that the great conservative philosopher Edmund Burke warned the British about during the war to prevent American independence. Edmund Burke, a man of Irish background and a very noted parliamentarian in Great Britain, wrote a letter to the sheriffs of Bristol, who were some of his constituents, in which he expressed a number of what were then considered to be shockingly seditious sympathies with the cause of the American colonists. And they all boiled down to the fundamental proposition that if the government of Imperial Britain could abuse the rights of Englishmen across the Atlantic in the American colonies, then the rights of Englishmen everywhere were made that less secure. And that's the fundamental proposition I'm urging upon you this afternoon, which is that if the government can withdraw the protection, the innate protection of law from any individual for any reason, then the rest of us are made that much more insecure. I'll give you a couple more tangible examples a little bit later on in the program. But one of the many services I intend to provide with this program is reverse Hannityization. I believe I'm the only specialist who performs that particular procedure. Hannityization, of course, is a radio-administered lobotomy. What I'm trying to do is restore that part of the brain that is removed by Hannityization that deals with critical thinking. So I hope that sometime in the next hour or the next half hour today or over the hours that we'll be together this week, I'll be able to administer that particular service to somebody who's desperately in need of it. I know many people have been Hannityized. It's a terrible, terrible thing to see. Now, we were talking about Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone magazine and his perspective on Obama. He starts out, quote, "I had an interesting discussion with a close friend of mine yesterday, a former journalist who quit the business years ago to get a real job. By the way, as a journalist, I can tell you that the one thing that terrifies us is the prospect of having to get an honest job." To continue, "We were talking about our early impressions of Obama, and while I kept harping on the bailouts and Obama's bizarre decision to hand the Treasury over to Goldman Sachs, my friend Kate kept coming back to Gitmo. He said he could understand how Obama, a young president with no background in economics, continually blasted for his lack of experience, could be bullied into handing over his economic policy to worn-out Wall Street gorgons like Larry Summers and Bob Rubin. Politically, you can see how that could happen. It's not as if, my friend pointed out, Obama could just hand over the Treasury to Paul Krugman and Simon Johnson and expect the Democratic Party honchos to go for it without complaint. Parenthetically, that would be just as bad an idea, handing over the Treasury to the likes of Paul Krugman. Mr. Krugman, of course, is militantly, passionately wrong about every single economic opinion that he's ventured upon the public. He's a winner of a Nobel Prize for economics, which pretty much tells you everything you need to know. They only hand out Nobel Prizes for economics recently in any way. I mean, Mr. Buchanan, not Pat Buchanan, there was a fellow by the name of Buchanan 25-some-odd years ago who was a Nobel Prize winner in economics for something that was actually worthwhile having to do with defending the free market. He's pretty much the only anomaly in an otherwise unbroken train of interventionist Marxists and collectivists who've won the Nobel Prize for economics. Paul Krugman would be just as bad as anybody from Goldman Sachs. To continue here, Mr. Tavey goes on, the Rubin-Summers axis was always going to be the default policy setting for a Democratic president, and it would require spending a lot of political capital to switch to a new paradigm. You can sort of see that maybe with the economic policies, Mr. Obama was sort of foredoomed to pursue the policy that he is pursuing, Tavey points out. If you were bent on clinging to the good king fantasy, you could hold your nose and imagine that Summers Rubin cast a spell on poor Barack, but this Gitmo thing is different. It's not like Barack Obama doesn't know what habeas corpus is. The guy was a freaking constitutional law professor, or senior lecturer, if that controversy over his academic title still rankles you. And yet Obama seems to be determined to preserve the whole concept of preventive detention, which is every bit as jarring and upsetting as the preemptive invasion concept Bush introduced. In fact, this whole Gitmo episode should serve as a reminder that the upper crust of the current Democratic leadership has not, for the most part, even publicly renounced preemption. Okay, what they're talking about when they mention preemption is nothing other than aggressive war, including potentially the use of preemptive nuclear strikes against targeted nations. Just in the last 24 hours, the Gorgonette, who is the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has suggested that we might take a preemptive nuclear strike or a preemptive policy and deliver a preemptive nuclear strike against Iran. There's been talk historically about the use of a preemptive nuclear strike against North Korea. As a matter of 15 years ago, 1994, I remember vividly, there was a conversation about the idea of using nuclear weapons against North Korea in the event that they developed a nuclear weapons capacity. You had people like Zbigniew Brzezinski on Crossfire and other programs of that sort talking about the use of nuclear weapons against North Korea. So preemption is nothing other than aggressive war. It's not been ruled out by Mr. Obama and by the Democratic Party leadership, and that's something that George W. Bush pioneered. While John Edwards a couple of years ago, continues Matt Taibbi, said that preemption was wrong on the merits, wrong on the morals, wrong for America, both Hillary and Obama have carefully avoided taking any public stance against it. True, back during the original war vote, Hillary did say that her yay vote should not be taken as, quote, a vote for any new doctrine of preemption, except that's exactly what the vote was, an endorsement of the preemption policy outlined in Bush's notorious national security strategy, the United States paper. And then he goes on to say, Obama has never really gone near the topic. He didn't talk about the U.S. having the right to respond to imminent threats, but it always seemed to mean a genuinely imminent threat, not the, quote, they might have some kind of unnamed weapon with or without a delivery system in 13 or 14 years, we better invade now, standard that Bush went by. Getting back to detention, it's important to remember that's what's going on at Gitmo. That what's going on at Gitmo has to be construed as a specific public endorsement of preventive detention. For all we know, there has always been preventive detention of one sort or another in this country ever since America became a world power. At the same time, we've tried never to allow ourselves to openly legalize these practices, such as the detention of suspected spies and so forth. When we have, like during the era of the Palmer raids, for instance, that was way back in the late 19-teens and 1920s, it's always been a black time in our history. Keeping preventive detention and extrajudicial punishment illegal puts a brake on their use. It forces the government that would use these tactics to enter a legal gray area to risk scandal and exposure, and to take all the responsibility for crossing the line. And of course, Barack Obama is on the wrong side of that line, much to the dismay of his progressive followers. Once again, Will Gregg, Pro Libertate Radio. Join us again after the break. Toll-free number, 866-986-6397. 1-866-986-NEWS. Hope to hear from you. Be back with you after the break.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
Hello again. Now, I had mentioned we needed to talk about the domestic application of a lot of the things that the Bush administration and the Obama administration have done with respect to foreign policy. That is to say, the use of preventive detention and the suspension of habeas corpus, the use of enhanced interrogation techniques in questioning suspected terrorists, and how these things have domestic application. By the way, when you talk about enhanced interrogation techniques and you use that particular phrase, you're employing the same euphemism that the National Socialists used in Germany to describe the same suite of torture techniques. You're talking about sleep deprivation, stress positions. They didn't use controlled drowning or what's commonly called waterboarding. The Imperial Japanese used waterboarding. So did the Khmer Rouge communists in Cambodia. And I think really what happened is the Japanese probably learned waterboarding from their study of what the American occupation troops did in the Philippines during the battle to suppress Philippine independence following the Spanish-American War. That lasted for about 3 or 4 years, and a couple of 100,000 people were killed. But they used what was called the water cure, the American occupation forces, when they were trying to find out what insurrectionists were doing. And they were called, by the way, irreconcilables. The Philippine independence movement were called irreconcilables. That's another, once again, of the expressions that I used at the beginning of the hour to describe people I'm trying to reach out to. They weren't reconciled to the idea of losing their independence to the United States any more than they wanted to be subject to Spain. They wanted to be independent. But we're talking about all these techniques being used to break down the personality, break down the resistance of people who are subject to authoritarian government policies, to make conspicuous, exemplary use of violence so as to deter the rest of us. I think a really good example of how these policies bleed into domestic application was given to us last week in Niagara Falls, New York, in this case involving Ryan Smith. He's about, I think, 21, 22 years old. He's an ex-con. He was sent to prison for a while for third-degree battery, I believe, or third-degree assault. He's suspected in a couple of crimes back in 2006 involving armed robbery. One of them was a kidnapping that also included armed robbery, and the other was a holdup of a convenience store. But he didn't want to give a DNA sample. He had given a DNA sample in August of last year, and it got lost by the police. They sent it to the wrong crime lab. The sample was opened. It was exposed. It was contaminated. It was useless. So the judge in the case, a lady by the name of Sarah Sheldon Sparazza, issued a second order ex parte, which is to say she didn't consult with the defense, as is required in cases of this sort under existing judicial precedent. She issued a second order for a DNA sample. This time Smith didn't want to cooperate. And so the police went to the district attorney and spoke with an assistant district attorney by the name of Hoffman and asked if they could be authorized to use force, to use duress, to compel this guy to give a DNA sample. And they were given permission to use the minimum necessary force, which doesn't really limit the amount of force that's used. What that means is that as soon as he's broken, you've used the minimum necessary force. If he holds out for as long as he can and you end up pulling his fingernails out, well, extraction of fingernails was the minimum necessary force in order to get him to submit. As it happens, they used electroshock torture. They used a taser set on drive stun, which involves applying the prongs of the taser directly to the skin of the victim. And this method of persuasion caused the suspect to become unconscious and hospitalized, but it did force him also to cough up the DNA sample. Well, the defense attorney for Mr. Smith was understandably distraught by this, and so he filed a motion to suppress the evidence that was being used in a 24-count criminal indictment against Smith. All of it had to do, of course, with the DNA sample that was used to connect him to these crimes. Oh, by the way, Smith was also charged with criminal contempt of court because his intransigence forced the investigators to torture him. So he was tortured and then charged with a crime that, in essence, was forcing his interrogators to torture him. It's a really interesting Orwellian proposition here that if they use torture against you, not only are you responsible for the fact that the torture is used against you, but you're the criminal because you forced them to torture you. In any case, Smith's defense attorney filed this motion to suppress with the same judge that had issued the ex parte order. Not surprising, the judge upheld the validity of the court order and the means used to enforce the order. She said as long as a taser is not used maliciously or excessively, then it's a perfectly suitable way to enforce a court order, which has interesting implications, of course, for matters of child support and other domestic arrangements where court orders are involved. It has interesting implications as well for interrogation, because what you're talking about here is, in the broadest possible terms, a form of interrogation. You've got a criminal suspect who refuses to provide something that is self-incriminating evidence, and so you use a taser in order to overcome his reluctance. They could have authorized waterboarding for the same purpose, because waterboarding, we're told, is a non-lethal means of interrogation, just as a taser is a non-lethal means of pain compliance. And anything in the nature of pain compliance that involves getting somebody to surrender information or to surrender evidence, I contend, is a form of torture. That's how we're using, in the domestic realm, the government ruling us, rather, is using these means of enhanced interrogation or torture that really have been gestating overseas and in black sites throughout the world at the hands of the CIA. I mean, potentially, under that precedent, if it's upheld, and I don't doubt for a second it's going to be appealed, if it's upheld, you could turn every single police interrogation room in this country into